is Cascadia Public Radio.
That's the one. That's the one out there. Let's go, Lay! Hey, that was pretty crazy. Welcome to the Unbought and Unbossed Show, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 136. Today is August the 26th, 2009. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the social and political issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offer further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either omitted or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your television off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. I say we must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. I suggest you find your role. Hey, very nice. As always, that's Bruce Coburn with Actions Speak Louder. Thank you, Bruce. We're also going to be hearing from DJ Shadow and Ashley McIsaac in the, I tell you what's going on. Okay, well, what's going on out there? What is the meaning of truth? You know, sometimes I feel like a bit of an ass, pretending to be some sort of truth-telling, I'm not going to say the word prophet, but truth-telling son of a gun anyways. And you know what? I can't really prove my conspiratorial interpretation of history as definitive. And so I guess I've had a bit of an epiphany this week. And what is truth? That's a real tough question, I think. I attempt to give weekly examples of evidence that I've collected primarily through the internet from around the world. Well, that strongly suggests that the corporate power elites are building a one-world government. And, this isn't going to be a good thing. It will be the end of our political and personal freedoms as we know them. Real important time in history. I'm sure people have said that for a long time, but I'm going to say it as well. The shitty truth is that I believe my truth is that we are quickly marching towards a global fascist empire. And, me saying that doesn't make it a fact. It doesn't make it truth. However, there's that saying, the more I learn, the less I know. And while, yes, I'll say that's true for the most part, one thing I'm learning is to ask the important questions. You know, whether I get to the answers or not might not really be all that important, but as long as my questions are evolving. So hopefully I'm on to something. The Oxford Dictionary definition of truth is the quality or state of being true in accordance with fact or reality. So there's a couple other big words, fact and reality and truth, and what does all that mean? What does that mean? I don't know. I've been collecting truth quotes this last week, and I'm going to share a couple with you. Let's start. This is another definition of truth. This is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's a 19th century essayist, philosopher, and poet. And he said, truth and goodness and beauty are but different faces of the same all. Maybe that's some of his transcendental philosophy there, but truth, goodness, and beauty are all the same thing. That's a neat idea. Moving back a little bit further, Plato, the classical Greek philosopher, he says that poetry is nearer to vital truth than is history. So the poets are the truth tellers, perhaps, according to that. Let's see what a president has to say. John F. Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, he has something interesting to say about truth. He says, the great enemy of the truth is very often not the lie, which is deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but it is the myth, which is persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. So there we are. It's, you know, like the myth of 9/11. You know, it didn't happen at all the way the myth states. And that's, I guess, you know, what this show is about. And so that's a pretty interesting one. I'm going to read one more. This comes to us from Albert Einstein. He's the 20th century German physicist. And he said that whoever undertakes to set himself up as a judge of truth and knowledge is shipwrecked by the laughter of the gods. That's a great line. So, you know, that line's been speaking to me, and you know how this is going to affect my show, I'm not too sure, but the word truth is bugging me, you know, because there's too many of them out there, and I've got one of them, and it's always changing as well, and that's a good thing. So that's, I guess, kind of my opening thoughts. However, I can truthfully tell you that I do hope to offer interesting ideas, hopefully new ideas to many people, as well as relevant ideas. That's the motivation for this show, to keep it interesting and to keep it real. And, well, what the heck is real, right? Well, let's get on to what I got set for you this show. I've got primarily audio clips. I don't have an interview tonight, nor am I going to be reading any news reports. The highlight of the show will come in the second hour. It is an interview. Barry Zwicker is interviewing Annie Michon. Now, Barry Zwicker is a Canadian author, journalist, media critic, and Annie Michon is formerly of MI5, Britain's spy agency. Well, she is a whistleblower, and she did a speaking tour in Canada a couple months back. As a matter of fact, Annie kicked off that tour by being on my radio show, so that was a pretty neat thing. But this happened when she was in Waterloo, Ontario, and this audio, well, it's a video clip, was submitted by Sinuvac from 9/11 Blogger, so thanks to that person, and I'm pretty sure this is from May 09. What else can I tell you? I guess the interview is in three stages, according to Barry Zwicker, who's the host of this discussion, and he sets it up as spies and spying, which Annie Michon knows a great deal about. Likewise, moving into false flag operations, various topics to do with that, and then finally the big picture. And it's a really swell conversation by these two fantastic and courageous, outspoken persons. Likewise, media issues are a big part, and likewise, secret societies. I guess that kind of comes into the big picture section. I've had the honor of having both Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon on the show in the past. If you missed those interviews, I certainly recommend them. Barry was number 117, and Annie was number 122, and we're at 136 right now. So that will be, that's a 45-minute piece, You're going to be glued. You're going to be glued to your radio for that. So very nice. Now, what do we have coming up in the first hour? First off, I guess, well, with my little kerfuffle on truth and what the heck is that, I guess my show was kind of branching out, you know, and it's has primarily been about the 9/11 truth movement, as well as the New World Order, and, you know, why was 9/11 done, you know, the issues behind that and who's responsible. But there's a lot of other things that I'm interested in, and we're going to hear a couple different ones today. For example, this one has to do with, well, unidentified flying objects, UFOs, and NASA, their space shuttle. They've done, I believe, currently 128 missions. However, the filmed footage from the space shuttle's 80th mission is, you're not going to see it, but you're going to hear a gentleman from the Netherlands make comment, detailed comment on what's being seen, and it is very fascinating, you know, and the idea of, you know, naysayers about UFOs or extraterrestrials, they'll say, well, why don't they just come out and show themselves? Well, they have, and this is one of the many examples. So, you know, let's put that in that camp. okay, oh, there's a couple new movies out in the truth world. First off, Alex Jones, his latest documentary, Fall of the Republic, The Presidents of Barack Obama. It is due out October 21st. So I'm going to play you that trailer. And then likewise, Michael Moore has a new film coming out. It's called Capitalism, A Love Story. And that's due out October 2nd. So another month for that one. So, but they both sound... Well, I watched both these gentlemen's movies when they're released, and I probably think you should too. You know, Michael Moore's taken a lot of heat, but what he's managed to do is remain in the public eye. Where? How else do I want to explain that? He's getting a lot of truth in, I guess is what I'm saying. And, you know, he's been criticized from the truth movement for not being nearly as truthful as others. But as Alex Jones, for example, but I still think that Michael Moore has, well, his heart's in the right place, and he's reaching a lot of people, and good for him. Okay, this is a fantastic piece. This Dr. Michio Keiko, I believe he's a Japanese gentleman. The short lecture is on the three different types of extraterrestrial civilizations. And I really like science fiction movies that are plausible. And so this fellow here labels them out as at level 1, 2, and 3. And he does a neat thing. He gives references to popular movies that we would understand that can place us in each of these levels. For example, the first one, I think he said Buck Rogers, which is an old... an older superhero type fellow, but basically in which the peoples, the civilization of a planet can manipulate, well, their planet, you know, their weather, their energy, you know, they have tremendous use of what they have to use. and this doctor says that we're nearing there, we're on the cusp. We're actually a zero right now because, you know, we're pretty dumb, you know, we're burning, you know, fossil fuels, you know, you know, weapons galore, you know, we're poisoning every aspect of our planet and our cultures. Okay, so moving on. Level two would be the world of Star Trek, in which Captain Kirk is sent on little missions to do things. And however, let's take it one leap larger. The third and highest form of extraterrestrial civilization would be the world of Star Wars, the Empire, and that, in which you have, you know, well, I guess command of, you know, many galaxies, you know, just the big one. And so, unfortunately, this Dr. Michio Keiko seems to favor a one-world government idea, and it seems because that would be the only way that the Earth could work, I guess, as a collective voice. I mean, there wouldn't be too much collective voicing going on, but, you know, at least it'd be working as one, I guess. So that's a little bit frustrating here. His the research he's done into extraterrestrial and their civilizations seems to me to be rather cutting edge. However, his makes a couple contemporary political comments, and sadly he remains in very much the official in officialdom. So he's far out in one way and yet very, very safe and factually incorrect in others. You know, when he for a short bit he's talking about global terrorism. And it just sounds like, our prime minister is pretty silly. So that is a very, very interesting piece. Likewise, I have a couple food audio pieces. This first one is from, it's a short piece put out by the American News Project, ANP, and it's called The Food Lobby Goes to School. And this is where the decisions of we're talking about the states here, but, we're not too far away from that kind of system. And how it is that we're poisoning our children, our young, with processed fast foods, and so this is fantastic insight. They go to a convention, and they're the only no mainstream press shows up. They're the only ones, and they did a really good story out of this. Okay, and then the second one, which is related quite well to that, is called Healing Quest, What Happens When Schools Care, like feeding real food to our children. And this piece comes from the Real Food Channel. I don't know if they're a .com or what they are, but Real Food Channel. And they're putting out lots of great stuff, as is Brass Check TV, which is where I get some of my audio clips from. You can visit them, Brass Check TV, I think they're a .com. So what happens when schools care? And they give examples of, brave school boards that have bucked the system and are taking care of their own. And pretty neat, pretty neat. Okay, another one here. This is, I guess, kind of returning to the science fiction idea, but this is along the truth lines. This is from a Discovery Channel show, Next World. And this fairly short piece, it's under 4 minutes. It's called The Merger of Man and Machine. And I believe this is 2 years old, but the technology that is out there that we are capable of is really, really remarkable. And, I'm old enough that I was brought up with Steve Austin, the $6 million man. And, we're getting there, So interesting, interesting stuff. Let's see, next week I'll tell you that I have, as a telephone interview guest, 9/11 truth activist and videographer Nathan Moulton. He's with Calgary 9/11 Truth, and he was on the show a couple months back talking about a film project, a documentary called Activist. This is a full-length piece, and it's going to be out real, real soon. So we're going to come back and talk about his film and 9/11 Truth, and there we are. So it is time to get the weather going, so let's do that, shall we? And we're going to move on now to getting into the audio clips. So where we're going to start is a clip from the movie The Matrix by the Wachowski brothers of 1999. It's a real famous scene right here with Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu Reeves. And it's fairly early into the movie where Lawrence Fishburne offers him, do you want the red pill or the blue pill? You can go back to sleep or we can wake you up to the truth. So what is The Matrix? That's what we're going to hear about. And then following that, a clip by Steve Schutzky. And this is called Our Amazing Solar System. And looking at, how we may have come to be on this fantastic little planet. And that's going to be followed by the comments by this chap from the Netherlands. He's going by Frost 2112-2012. So this is comments of filmed footage during NASA's Space Shuttle's 80th mission. And there we are. I will let you know that I archive these shows. I also have a website that tells you what was on, includes links to many of the different clips. And so that is, if you want to check out past shows, like, you know, I was telling you, the Annie Michon interview, number 122, and the Barry Zwicker interview, issue, or episode number 117, you can go back and listen to those if you missed them. But I really think you're going to be impressed with Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon. It is a fantastic lecture. That'll be in the second hour. So let's move on to The Matrix, Our Amazing Solar System, and then comments concerning the video footage that NASA shot at the Space Shuttle's 80th mission. Okay, and then I'll come back and talk to you then. So, of course, you're listening to CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM. You can also listen online at www.chly.ca. I'm your host, Raymond. This is the Unbought and Unbossed Show.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Stars were formed. When their fuel was used up, the ancient stars died, some violently, leaving vast clouds of interstellar gas and dust. One of these clouds lay dark, cold, and silent for a very long time. Then, over 4.5 billion years ago, it began to collapse, perhaps triggered by the explosion of a nearby star. The cloud was pulled inward by its own gravity into a flat spinning disk. At the center, a star began to form. From the leftover matter, planets were taking shape. Finally, the new star flared into life. The miracle of creation had begun anew. Now, 4.5 billion years later, a new miracle has evolved. Intelligent life, reaching out beyond the planet of its birth. In this golden age of discovery, we have seen worlds of infinite wonder. This is the story of these worlds and the star that rules their lives. This is the story of our amazing solar system.
Well, people always say to me, you know, if there's extraterrestrials and if there's UFOs, why don't they make themselves known to us publicly? Well, I think with the space shuttle mission STS-80, that's exactly what they did do. You see objects which are out of focus, or they are transparent in some kind of way. And the first one comes from behind the space shuttle, comes into the field of view, and they make their way to the upper atmosphere. That's at least what it looks like. It's joined by many others, and you get a kind of rough circular formation appearing. And then you get the piece de resistance, the last orb comes into the center of this formation, and as soon as it finds its position, it lights up. And then you can see a sort of dance of lights around this formation. Now, this suggests to me incredible intelligence. It suggests to me that they are saying, look at us, look how clever we are. And it's an astounding piece of footage. These extraterrestrial craft are attracted to thunderstorms. Many, many times we see lightning on the surface of the planet or in the atmosphere of planet Earth. And as soon as these electric storms start, the UFOs swarm into the area. It's almost as if they're harvesting the electromagnetic energy within the atmosphere. And in actual fact, there are unseen forces in the atmosphere, etheric flows of what the German scientist Wilhelm Reich described as orgone energy. And it could be possible that these UFOs are sucking energy from these electric thunderstorms on planet Earth, and this is where they're getting their energy from. You should concentrate on the first object that appears, and you will see that it holds its position. Many TV stations have actually broadcast this STS-80 footage, but they only show you the few seconds of the large glowing orb coming from the lower atmosphere. The cameraman who's operating the space shuttle camera is fully aware that the first object has held its position. And after the large orb has ascended from the lower atmosphere, and the shuttle is moving away from the scene, the cameraman is actually zooming in at the end of the sequence to double check the position of the first luminous orb. And it's a fascinating piece of video.
Okay, there we are. What did we hear there? That was Frost, 2112, 2012. Fellow from the Netherlands talking about this amazing footage that is from NASA's space shuttle from their 80th mission. And again, I told you about my website. I've got a link to that YouTube clip. I never gave the address. I don't think unbossed.livejournal.com is my website, unbossed.livejournal.com. Yeah, G called in during that, and basically it's the same thing. Like, what is truth, man? I mean, you know, how do you define truth? You know, then he said, well, you know, unless you were there and you actually saw it with your own eyes, who knows what's truth, you know? And that's the crazy thing, you know? And when the Internet first started becoming popular, you would quite often hear newscasters, the corporate newscasters, saying, well, be careful, you know, be careful what you get on the Internet because there's a lot of crazies out there, right? And that was, you know, a fear tactic to say, well, don't believe, well, I guess conspiracy theories, you know, don't ever think that, you know, the global elite have got their poop in a group and that they're working on some evil plans because, well, because that's a conspiracy theory. So it's not possible, right? Anyways, so, but that's the fascinating thing about the Internet. There is so much out there, and you really have to take a lot of it with a grain of salt. You know, the more research you do, the better shape you're going to be in. Yeah, that's kind of my philosophy on that. Just learn as much as you can from as many different places as possible, and then you still won't get to the truth. Okay, so where are we going to go now? I've got this funky little poem, and the music is absolutely haunting. I came across this maybe 2 days ago. I've played it a dozen times, and it's really scary and frightening, and I don't know what to do about it other than share it with you. Now, this is A Message from the Future. That's the name of this poem, and it's spoken in Spanish, not very intelligibly. And the author, it's also a video, so the poem and the video was put together by Instinct, as well as Alberto A.S. So it is a poem, and you're not going to get it, because, like I said, it's from the future, and they had a bit of a communication breakdown, and it's a little bit staticky, but of course it's supposed to sound that way. So I'm going to read you the poem, and it's pretty haunting, and then I'll play it for you, and then it's really going to scare you. So, Message is from the Future, and this is by Instinct and Alberto A.S. The contrast of our feelings, the critical eyes that surround us, the hope, the life, the hatred, the details, so small and so important, the looks, secret messages that act on the human conduct, the anger, accumulated for wanting to improve the world and not to obtain anything. You think and think, I transform, put on my mask, and this way I show the small part of my person doing what we distrust the whole world. Did you catch that? Did you catch that? That's a message from the future, apparently. That's what we're told. So that singing, that haunting music in the background. I thought that it was a song being played backwards. That's what I thought. I don't know if someone else agrees or disagrees. Another friend of mine said that, no, that's just they're singing in Spanish. I said, oh, gee, I thought maybe it was in Italian and backwards. So, oh, who knows? Getting back to the idea of truth, I've got a couple more quotes I'm going to share with you. And what is truth? That is the $64,000 question. Let's move on. Let's see. I had a president. Let's move on to J. Edgar Hoover. He was the first director of the FBI. And he has some good advice. And he says, above all, I would teach him to tell the truth. Truth-telling, I have found, is the key to responsible citizenship. The thousands of criminals I have seen in 40 years of law enforcement have had one thing in common. Every single one was a liar. Now, he's not too clear whether he's talking about the people he worked with or the people that went behind bars. I think to get high up in the FBI, you have to have proven yourself to sit on some truth. And until you can do that, you're not advancing in your career. That is how that works. Maybe, maybe not. Let's move on to Margaret Mead. She's a 20th century American cultural anthropologist. And this is a neat one, and I kind of feel that this also fits for me. Margaret says, I was brought up to believe that the only thing worth doing was to add to the sum of accurate information in the world. That's a pretty neat one, eh? Add to the sum of accurate information. Neato. Oh, this next one, let's move into a spiritual teacher here. Buddha. He was said to be the spiritual teacher from India. However, most everything we know about this man is debatable. You know, we don't have dates, and, you know, maybe many of the sayings attributed to him were of many different spiritual leaders. So we don't know a whole lot about this fellow. And this is the quote. And it says, believe nothing just because a so-called wise person said it. Believe nothing just because a belief is generally held, or because it is said in ancient books. Believe nothing just because it is said to be of divine origin, or because someone else believes it. Believe only what you yourself test and judge to be true. Indeed. Hear, hear. Believe only what you yourself test and judge to be true. Kids in school, kids at university, hold on to that. I think one of the smartest things that you could say to your prof is, sorry, buddy, I don't believe you. That's, I've said that a couple times in my days, and I didn't necessarily get favorable looks, but, well, that's just the way it was that day, I guess. And, let's move on. I have one final topic on truth here. What is it? And this is Bertrand Russell. He's a 20th century British philosopher. And he says that what I'm going to be reading you is that the origin of myths are explained this way. And he's talking about desires and instincts. So listen close. This is a good one here. So Bertrand Russell. What a man believes upon grossly insufficient evidence is an index to his desires. Desires of which he himself is often unconscious. If a man is offered a fact which goes against his instincts, he will scrutinize it closely, and unless the evidence is overwhelming, he will refuse to believe it. If, on the other hand, he is offered something which affords a reason for acting in accordance to his instincts, he will accept it, even on the slightest of evidence. the origin of myths is explained in this way. Bertrand Russell. So, yeah, there's a lot of different truths for a lot of different people out there, I suppose. What are your innermost desires and instincts? And that might shape your world of truth. Okay, we're going to move on to the audio. More audio clips. These are the trailers of two films that will be out before too long. The first one is Alex Jones' latest documentary. It's called Fall of the Republic, The Presidents of Barack Obama, due out in mid-late October. And we're also going to hear Michael Moore's latest movie trailer. It's called Capitalism, A Love Story. And that's due out in about a month. So let's give those a listen, and then we'll talk to you shortly.
Last week, the head of the country's central bank floated the idea of dumping the greenback as the world's reserve currency, replacing it with an international currency.
Thousands of people gathered to hear Barack Obama deliver key foreign policy speech on his current European tour. His vision for America's place in a new world order.
Returning vets could be a risk to our nation.
We've got to give them a stake in creating the kind of world order that I think all of us would like to see.
And one of the ways it will drive the change is through global governance.
I think the new world order is emerging.
This is a hoax and a scam which is designed to transfer wealth and power from the private sector to the government sector and from the government of the United States to a world government.
And those people who have been yelling, oh, the UN's going to take over global
conspiracy
government.
Conspiracy theorists.
They've been crazy, but now they're right.
And who got the money? Hundreds and hundreds of banks, any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve System.
Yeah. Tell us who they are.
No.
You know, financial terrorism. They have the ability to tweak the knob.
I am proposing that the Federal Reserve be granted new authority.
The ultimate goal of the carbon tax and the cap and trade is to destroy production.
This energy tax is the largest tax increase in American history.
We're actually creating a global warming police. So number one, they can come in, the federal government can come in, inspect your house, and send you the bill. We're setting up a global warming Gestapo.
One of the things that if you talk to our generals, they are desperate for is a civilian counterpart to our military forces.
I am fierce.
And this is what I wear.
Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign is asking Missouri law enforcement to target anyone who lies or runs a misleading television ad.
I've now been in 57 states. I think one left to go.
The president, when he was in Europe last week, he met with the king of Saudi Arabia. He appeared to bow.
President Obama today proposed something new, something called prolonged detention. Pre-crime is where people are arrested and incarcerated to prevent crimes that they have not yet committed.
This is Michael Moore. I am here to make a citizen's arrest of the board of directors of AIG.
From Michael Moore.
We're actually here to make a citizen's arrest.
Speak to my supervisor.
In the white shirt?
Yep.
Blue tie?
That's it.
Receding hairline?
The guy who brought you Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Sicko.
Who else do you want to leave the building?
Your cameraman and your
crew. Oh, come on out. All right, they don't speak English. Donde?
This fall, the most feared filmmaker in America.
Can I talk to you, sir, for a second? Can you tell me what a credit default swap is? Can you explain a derivative to me?
Will reveal what happens when Wall Street tanks.
Stock markets crash.
Bankruptcy.
Foreclosures.
A global meltdown.
And the government fails.
By spending just a few million dollars to buy Congress, Wall Street was given billions.
The motion is adopted.
You know, Michael Moore is, don't you, Betty? The film director, he's filming me right now.
How did this collapse happen?
I got home on a Friday. Everything was just fine. I called back after my plane landed in Indiana, and all of a sudden we've got this crisis on our hands.
There's got to be some kind of a rebellion between the people that have nothing and the people that got it all.
Everything was being handled by the Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs. They had Congress right where they wanted them. This was almost like an intelligence operation.
This is straight up capitalism.
Where's our money?
I don't know.
The people here really aren't in charge.
I guess you win.
We want our money back.
Capitalism offers people the freedom to choose where they work.
There isn't anything in here. I'm not going to be a gentleman's club hire dancer.
We're here to get the money back for the American people. I got more bags. $10 billion probably won't fit in here.
Okay, there it is. Michael Moore's got a new film coming out, Capitalism, A Love Story. And before we heard an Alex Jones trailer, we didn't actually hear Alex Jones in there. That's interesting. Usually he kind of loves the limelight. You know, he's this real energetic fellow, and so that's something a little bit different. Okay, very nice. We're going to move on now to talk about extraterrestrial civilizations. And this one scientist here says that there are three different types, levels of intelligence, and what you can manipulate. You know, we're manipulating our planet pretty well, and, we're on the cusp of becoming a first-type civilization, and there's two more above that that are even more spectacular, provided they don't kill themselves first. So, yeah, you've got to graduate to, you've got to survive to be a step one Type 1 civilization. So let's give this a listen. This is Michio Kaku. Good stuff. Enjoy.
When we physicists look in outer space for alien life, we don't look for little green men. We look for Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 civilizations. A Type 1 civilization has harnessed planetary power. They control earthquakes, the weather, volcanoes. They have cities on the ocean. Anything planetary, they control. That's Type 1. A Type 2 civilization is stellar. They've exhausted the power of a planet, and they get their energy directly from their mother star. They don't get a suntan on a weekend. They use solar flares. They use the power of the sun itself to energize their huge machines. Eventually, they exhaust the power of a star, and they go galactic. They harness the power of billions of stars within a galaxy. Now, for example, Buck Rogers would correspond to a Type 1 civilization, a planetary civilization. Star Trek and the Federation of Planets, who have colonized a few star systems, would correspond to a Type 2 system. And the Empire of Star Wars would correspond to a Type 3 civilization. Now, what are we on this scale? We are Type 0. We don't even rate on this scale. We get our energy from, not from stars or galaxies, we get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal. But we can calculate when we will attain Type 1 status, in about 100 years. Now, every time I read the newspaper, I see evidence of this historic transition from Type 0 to Type 1. And I am privileged to be alive in the most important era in the history of the human race, the transition from Type 0 to Type 1. I read the newspaper and I see evidence of this everywhere. What is the European Union? The European Union has been formed to oppose NAFTA, that is, the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But why? Because we're seeing the beginnings of a Type 1 economy. Huge planetary trading blocks are the beginnings of a Type 1 economy. And what language will this Type 1 economy speak? Everywhere I go around the world, I find that the elites all speak English as a second language. In the future, the planet Earth will be like that. Everyone will speak their own native language, but on top of that, there will be a Type 1 language, probably English. There's also going to be a Type 1 culture and a Type 1 political system as well. You can go anywhere on the planet Earth and show people pictures of two individuals. that are instantly recognizable by any human. Madonna and Arnold Schwarzenegger. In other words, we're talking about Hollywood movies. We're talking about rock and roll, rap music, blue jeans. That's going to be the planetary culture of the planet Earth. And what is the Internet? The Internet is the beginning of a Type 1 telephone system. That's all it is. And so this transition is perhaps the most important transition of all time. Some people don't want it. They fear this transition because this transition is to a planetary civilization tolerant of many cultures. These are the terrorists. In their gut, they fear this because they know they are witnessing the birth pangs of a beginning of a new planetary civilization, and the terrorists want nothing to do with it. This transition is also the most important because it's not clear if we're going to make it. When we look at outer space, we see no evidence of Type 1, 2, or 3 anywhere. No evidence whatsoever. The mathematics say that there should be thousands of Type 1, 2, and 3 civilizations in the galaxy. We see no evidence of any whatsoever. And why is that? Because the transition from Type 0 to Type 1 is the most dangerous of all transitions. We may not make it. It's a race against time. On one hand, we have the forces of integration, the forces of tolerance, a multicultural fabric emerging before our eyes. On the other hand, we have weapons of mass destruction, germ warfare, nuclear warfare, also the rise of international terrorism. They are obstacles to reaching a Type 1 civilization. So in other words, perhaps they didn't make it in outer space. If one day we have starships and visit other star systems, perhaps we'll find planets whose atmospheres are irradiated or whose atmospheres are too hot to bear life because they did not make the transition from Type 0 to Type 1. Now, by the time you're Type 2, you are immortal. Nothing known to science can destroy a Type 2 civilization. Even a supernova cannot destroy a Type 2 civilization. They'll either move their home planet or they'll simply stop the nuclear fires from exploding. And by the time a civilization becomes galactic, they may in fact have the ability to control the fate of the galaxy itself. By the way, if you're Type 3, you will explore the galaxy not by sending Captain Kirk on an Enterprise hopping from star system to star system. That would take millions of years to explore the Milky Way galaxy. The way you do it is you would create a robot. Have the robot land on a moon. It would create a factory. It would make millions of copies of itself on this moon, which is quite stable, and send these to other moons. Then each of these would create another factory. Starting with one robot, you would have a million, then a million million, and a million million million, until you had a sphere expanding near the speed of light containing trillions of these robots. They would land on a moon and simply wait. Wait for a Type 0 civilization to become Type 1. Now, where have you seen that before? This is the basis of the movie 2001. The movie 2001 is perhaps the most authentic rendition of the encounter of a Type 0 civilization with a Type 3 civilization. Now, at the beginning of the movie, Stanley Kubrick interviewed many leading astronomers and scientists, and we laid out this scenario, that the most efficient way to colonize a galaxy is to send robots, have them land on the moon, and create a factory, and then they would shoot out and colonize other moons. But at the last minute, Kubrick cut the first 5 minutes of his own film, and the film became super mystical. But the next time you see that movie, realize that the monolith on the moon is perhaps a remnant of a passing Type 3 civilization waiting for our Type 0 civilization to become Type 1. And how long before we have an operating moon base capable of detecting such a monolith? Perhaps 100 years. So again, the generation now alive and our grandchildren are the most important generations ever to walk the surface of the Earth. We are the generations that will determine whether we make the transition from type 0 to type 1 or we destroy ourselves because of our arrogance and our weapons.
Hey, welcome back. There we are. So I got a phone call calling Michio Kaku, a New World Order shill. And, a buddy that called was ready to puke. He was not impressed with him calling for a one-world government. And, talking about the terrorists, how ridiculous was that? Yes, I hear you there, brother. However, I thought his other ideas, looking at different potential extraterrestrial civilizations, was really fascinating. And interesting stuff. But like I said earlier, it was certainly a case of officialdom there, and so interesting stuff. Okay, so where we're going to go right now, I had two foodie-type audio clips. We're only going to get to one of them because I do want to make sure that I start on time for the Barry Zwicker interviewing Annie Michon from Waterloo a couple months back. That is a brilliant piece of conversation, and I know you're going to enjoy that. So where we're going to go right now is this piece, The Food Lobby Goes to School, and this is put out by the American News Project, and I guess they went to a conference, and they were the only media there. No one else is covering, how it is that we're poisoning our children in school. And unfortunately, there was, on the flip side, the second audio clip, which I'm not going to have time for, shows what happens when schools care. And, a lot of the problems that seem to be associated with, the garbage in the food, it has fast and very positive changes to people's behavior by what they feed them. So this is quite an amazing piece here. The Food Lobby Goes to School. That's what we're going to hear next. And then I guess we're going to be doing the campus community updates after that. So stay tuned. This is the Unbought and Unbossed show on CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM and live streaming at www.chly.ca. Be well out there.
For every public photo op, there are countless meetings, phone calls, and conferences behind the scenes where decisions are shaped that affect the lives of millions. Case in point, a recent conference at the National Academy of Sciences. There was no media there, other than ANP. And on the surface, it appeared to be a mundane and uneventful scientific discussion on child nutrition. But in fact, the politics behind these PowerPoint presentations will emerge in some of the most vulnerable and chaotic locales in the country, school cafeterias. Every day during the school year, lunch is served to over 30 million students nationwide. And every 5 years, Congress and the Department of Agriculture reauthorize something called the National School Lunch Program. It's a chance to shape the eating habits of students, what they eat, and how much they eat. This year, the National School Lunch Program is set to be renewed once again. And a battle, which is fought every 5 years, is coming to another juncture.
Kids today are so affected by what they eat. A third of kids are either overweight or obese. A quarter of kids, because their diets are so bad, already show early warning signs for heart disease and diabetes. They have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or high blood glucose. We are seeing diseases in children that used to only be seen in adults, like type 2 diabetes. They had to rename type 2 diabetes. They can't call it adult onset diabetes anymore because so many kids are affected.
And this brings us back to our seemingly ordinary meeting. The USDA has asked the committee at the Institute of Medicine, part of the Academy of Sciences, to compile a list of evidence-based revisions to the school lunch program.
As all of you know, that we really need to be an evidence-based panel.
Given all the politics around food, it's very difficult for USDA to come out with truly science-based standards without getting hassled by a lot of different food and beverage companies. And so USDA has punted this over to the Institute of Medicine. Lobbying a scientist is not the same as lobbying a politician.
But obviously, that doesn't mean industry lobbyists are waving a white flag.
Who are you and who are you with and why are you here?
My name's Tom Kruk. I'm with PepsiCo Food Service. I'm just here for information gathering to understand the trends and the needs of what's happening next with the industry.
Anytime there's a government-sponsored meeting that will affect national nutrition policy, you're going to have a lot of industry folks in the room because they have a lot at stake. The school lunch and breakfast program are $10 billion programs each year. And so companies want to sell their products.
Which is why the man from Pepsi wasn't alone. Sitting behind members of the Institute of Medicine and among USDA officials were representatives with Sarah Lee, Campbell Soup, the soy and dairy lobbies were there along with their respective law firms. The egg lobby sat near the bakers associations, and food processors sat among HMOs. Porter Novelli, a PR firm for McDonald's, was just a few feet from Byrnes Communications. The Grocers Manufacturers of America, a massive trade group which has lobbied to oppose efforts to remove junk food from schools, had multiple members in attendance. The law firm Pal Tate, which used to represent cigarette giant R.J. Reynolds, was sitting next to its new client, the National Pork Board. This raises the question, does this look like a scientific conference?
There is a trade group for almost every food category, commodity you can think of, and many of these commodity groups are very influential and powerful. They have a lot of access in Washington.
Access. Outside the meeting, in the public hallway, ANP overheard two lobbyists discussing their legislative strategy. A typical discussion for a lobbyist in Washington, but one that is often unseen and unheard.
Executive VP in our office is just very sharp and very totally understands how to help assist with legislative effort and use the work for Hartman. She's beyond the staff. She's a communications and communications person. Such a thing is on our staff, so I thought, well, I got it.
Back in the room, the National Pork Board was finishing their presentation about why more pork products should be sold in schools.
In these recessionary times, pork products are a wise choice for budget-stretched schools. Despite a record year of rising commodity prices in 2008, pork prices rose less than 5%.
The representatives from Pal Tate seemed happy with their new client, but they weren't happy to answer any questions.
Hi, Stephen Greensheet, American Food. So can I ask why the National Pork Board is at a scientific discussion about school nutrition?
I had a fellow advocate say to me, she wished there were no politics that came into play when we talked about our children's health. And it's a very lovely idea, but when you're talking about billions of dollars worth of marketing, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of food, these are big businesses, and they're going to have an influence.
The Institute of Medicine will issue its final list of revisions to the USDA later this year. With billions of dollars and millions of calories riding on the outcome, the movers and shakers in Washington may find that change is hard to swallow.
Hey friends, how you doing? Hey, what do you think of those food lobbyists, eh? Scary stuff, scary stuff. Okay, one final advertisement. This is concerning an action taking place at downtown Vancouver this coming Friday, August the 28th. It is from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery. And what we got going on here, this is sponsored by falseflagflu.com. And here, let me read what I have here. There's going to be a number of speakers, including Kevin Annett, a regular guest on this show, talking about this H1N1 flu virus as well as the vaccinations. Okay, so this will be followed by a march in the downtown area that will take us to the CBC building to demand objective, honest reporting on H1N1 and vaccines. Then there's going to be a second event that day, hosted by Kevin Annett, which will take place at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library. Similar demonstrations are being planned in a number of cities. For example, Toronto. Theirs is happening Saturday, August 29th, at Dundas Square from 1 to 9 p.m. So that's an all-day event that's put on by the Toronto Truthers. Also, Ottawa is planning something as well. To find out the specifics, you can go to the We Are Change Ottawa website. Other places you can... let's see, this says that we hope to have people from across Canada follow up with their own street actions in their own towns on the weekend of August 29th and 30th to help inform our fellow citizens about vaccine dangers. We encourage peaceful, responsible, civil action only. Please join them. For more information and updates, you can visit the following websites: falseflagflu.com, vaccineresistancemovement.org, and hiddenfromhistory.org. Okay, so that's this coming Friday, downtown Vancouver Art Gallery from 4 to 6, and another one at 7 at the public library. Okay, very nice. So the efforts of those people. So I want to thank the following financial supporters of CHLY and the Unbought and Unbossed show. So I would like to thank WarCriminalsOut.com, Edmonton 9/11 Truth Group, and the Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth Group. Thank you very much for your financial support to keep this very important independent radio station going. So very nice. Okay, well, it is time to get the Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon interview on. It's really more of a discussion. These two intelligent people. Again, Barry Zwicker is a Canadian media critic and a journalist, is a career man in those field. And Annie Michon is a former spy with the MI5, Britain's internal spy agency or national spy agency. And it just about started a little prematurely for me. So I pulled this off of 911blogger.com. It was submitted by Sinuvac. This takes place at the University of Waterloo. This is May 09. And so I hope you enjoy this. Again, I've had both of these speakers on my show in the past. Barry was on episode number 117. Annie was on 122. So if you like what these people have to say and you want to hear a full... well, an even longer interview with these persons. Very nice. So that's going to be the rest of the show tonight. So thank you for tuning in. Well, I'm going to come in every now and again and let new people that are listening know what's going on. So you'll hear me once or twice more. So there we are. Interview with Barry Zwicker, Annie Michon from the University of Waterloo. They're going to be talking about spies, spying, false flag operations, as well as the big picture. Of course, media issues come into that quite a bit. So I hope you enjoy this, and we'll talk to you before long. Be well, friends.
Now, what I would like to do, what we agreed to do, is to find out first from you people where you stand on 9/11, what your take is about the events of 9/11. And so what I'm going to do is just give you four choices. They pretty well cover the waterfront as far as ideas about 9/11 are concerned. I'll give you four choices and then ask for hands up on each choice after I give them. So the first take on 9/11 would be what you might call the official story that 19 crazed Muslims outsmarted all of the U.S. intelligence and military and diplomatic and political establishments and carried off 9/11. The second would be something called the incompetence theory, and that would be that American intelligence officials knew something about the impending attack by these 19 crazed Muslims, but through various kinds of incompetence at various levels, were unable to prevent or even ameliorate these events. That's the second choice. The third choice is that American intelligence knew a lot about this, but deliberately decided to allow the attacks to go ahead anyway, in order to benefit whatever political goals the White House had at that time. And those first three have something in common. They all posit that there were, in fact, 19 crazed Muslims who did this. The fourth choice, which you could call the inside choice or made it happen on purpose theory, is that, in fact, the whole thing was planned and executed at the highest levels, and it was an inside job. So those are the four choices. So now I'm going to ask for hands up. You have to be honest or there's no point. How many people here believe what we have officially been told about the events of 9/11? The official story of 9/11, that 19 crazed Muslims... That's number one. Yeah, that's what I'm asking for hand up. Yeah. Well, we're having no hands on that one, which is not that uncommon these days. Second choice is incompetence is the basic explanation. So how many people believe that that, in fact, explains the events of that day, that there was incompetence? Yeah, so... There's a dozen of us. How many people here believe that it was allowed to happen on purpose? Which is another... almost identical. And so finally, how many people here believe that it was an inside job? Okay. That's about 20. So we have 0, 12, 12, and 20, which is a good spread. Okay. And that gives us all a chance of knowing where we're at, and we can proceed accordingly. The questions that I've prepared for Annie are, I'm just going to group them into three. First is spies and spying. By the way, Annie hasn't heard these questions. We offered to show them to her, and she said she didn't need to see them. And we all agreed it's more refreshing to have... unrehearsed conversation here.
I would hope.
Yeah, I would hope. And also, I'd point out that when Bush and Clinton were in Toronto on Friday, the moderator, Frank McKenna, showed them all the questions. And so apparently that was a complete snooze fest. So we don't want to do the Bush-Clinton thing here. But we are in green chairs like they had.
We're not charging $200.
And we're not charging $200, $300, $500. So the first section of questions would be about spies and spying, and Annie knows a tremendous amount about that. Second is false flag operations in general, but 9/11 in particular. And the third is the big picture and what might we expect, what does Annie feel that we'll see for the future. So will you first just sketch out, we have 50 minutes here, maybe 45 now.
Okay.
How did you come to be in a spy world?
Well, I sort of fell into it by accident. I never wanted to be a spy or even thought about being a spy. After I graduated from university, I applied to a publishing house and started a career there, and then just found it slightly underwhelming. So then I applied to become a diplomat. I sat the Foreign Office exams in the UK and then had a letter on Ministry of Defence-headed notepaper which said, we may have other jobs you find more interesting. And that freaked me out. I mean, I immediately thought, my God, it's MI5. And I was really, really frightened. I mean, what did they want with someone like me? My father, however, was with me when I opened the letter. So it's all his fault, as I always say. But he was a real spy buff, and he was also a journalist. So he was agog to find out if it was indeed MI5. So he said, oh, go on, just ring this telephone number. Please, see what it is. And about a month later, I found myself in an unmarked office block in central London, being interviewed very intensively about my life from the age of 12. And then it took about 10 months to recruit me. It was a very intensive process, many, many interviews, role plays, assessments, interviews with psychiatrists, senior intelligence officers, that type of thing. And it went on for months, and there was also the vetting process. And because it's MI5, you always think they know everything about you already. So you just throw everything at them, and they still wanted me back. And there were quite a lot of discussions as well about their ethics and the sort of work that they were now planning to do, because when I was recruited in 1990, they had shifted, they told me, their focus of work away from political activism and Reds Under the Bed, and they wanted a new type of officer who could cope with looking at counterterrorism. And they had long discussions about the ethics. Should we intern people, put them in prison without trial? Is it right to shoot to kill? Is it right to torture? All those sort of things. And my views were the same then as they are now, and I told them all this, and they still kept inviting me back. So I was very surprised, really, when they finally offered me a job, to be quite frank. But I thought, well, they know all about me. I must be right for the job.
Now, you mentioned psychiatric assessment. What's your knowledge? Are the psychological characteristics that, to be specific, MI5, mm-hmm. to your knowledge, was looking for?
Well, interestingly, in my last year in MI5, I was actually trained up to be a recruiter. This was the first year in which they were openly trying to recruit people. They were advertising for them in the media and saying, would you like to work for MI5? And they got flooded with applicants, about 20,000 in the first round, of which they chose five. So they had their pick of good graduates. And the sort of things they were looking for were obviously intelligence, mental intelligence, good analytical skills, good communication skills, the ability to influence other people. So if you went out into the field and had to deal with agents, they would trust you. But also things like tenacity and an ethical framework within which you worked. So basically they wanted everything. They wanted a very rounded human being who could do a wide variety of work. And because they're MI5 and because they sounded glamorous and because they never told the recruits exactly what they'd be getting up to when they joined, they got those sort of people. What they then found, of course, was they couldn't retain them.
Mm-hmm. It sounded, from the profile you mentioned, that it would be an ideal employee for any company or organization. So,
absolutely.
But what about those people that they recruit, if you have this knowledge, for the darker side of the spy business, those people who will work in covert actions and may have to do everything up, betraying, entrapping people, mm-hmm. up to killing people? Mm-hmm. Do you have any knowledge of how, as one friend who suggested this question to me said, that such people are found and indoctrinated?
Well, it's certainly in the UK, it's a little different, I think, from the American and Canadian intelligence infrastructure. What they have is they have a split. They have intelligence officers who are full-time employees who organize the operations, run the operations, and assess the information that comes out of them. And that's what I was. So you work for MI5. The people you're talking about are then defined as agents. So they don't work. They're sort of like contractors. And they are employed by MI5 to infiltrate organizations or to go and bug people's houses or whatever. So they're the sort of cutout. They are the ones who do have to befriend people in groups, are the ones who betray those friendships and report back. And it's an interesting psychological study of why people will do that. MI5 always had this thing which they had a little acronym for, which was MICE, which was money, idealism, compromise, and ego. So you could buy someone to do it, they would do it for ideological belief, you caught them out in an embarrassing situation and blackmailed them, or you flattered them. You basically said, come on, do something really good, we know you can do it, but nobody else can. Mm-hmm. So that was how they got the agents to infiltrate these groups. However, in the UK, what we've seen worryingly in the last few years is a sort of explosion in private security firms as well. In the US, notoriously, we have Blackwater, which has gone into Iraq and murdered people with legal impunity. But in the UK, we have other companies like Kroll or Diligence, which in fact was set up by one of my colleagues and is doing very well. And they get paid by big corporations primarily to go and spy on activist groups. So, you know, an arms company is worried about some protesters, they buy the services of these companies, or environmental camps and things like that. So there's a sort of the official spies who have very little oversight anyway from the government. Then you have the unofficial spies, many of whom are former ex-spooks anyway, doing all this stuff completely outside the law.
What would be the, to your knowledge, the split now between the official spies who are paid by the government and these contract spies? I mean, how I've read figures in the U.S. that Blackwater is huge. It's the largest private army in the world. Yeah. What's the situation, to your knowledge?
From what I've seen, very similar. MI5 in my day had about 2,000 full-time staff. And out of that, there would probably be about 400 or 500 intelligence officers, and the rest were support staff. Now they have virtually doubled that number, but that's still quite a small organization. And then, of course, you have the agents around that organization who are infiltrating the groups. In terms of the commercial companies, they are massive. I mean, we're talking many, many large companies. And there have been a series of scandals over the last few years revealed in the UK press of people who have been caught out spying on these activist groups. So, you know, who can tell what's happening with meetings like this as well? Certainly in the UK, there may well be infiltration from MI5 agents. I would say there almost certainly would be infiltration from the police, because there's a sort of second tier of intelligence work in the UK where we have the secret police doing this sort of thing. And possibly as well, of course, these commercial spies. And they could actually all be running around treading each other's as well. Because
they normally don't know each other,
exactly,
do they?
Exactly. Yeah. So they can cause each other problems as well.
Yeah. Now, you're in the spy agency now, and you and a partner, David Shaler, a fellow MI5 employee, and you people fell in love, and you became partners in that way. But then you both became disillusioned. And can you tell us, skip forward to when you did and why you did become disillusioned and became whistleblowers?
Yeah. David Shaler and I met in our first section, which was the political subversion section, which we helped to shut down, actually. And we were both in MI5 for about 6 years. And during that time, in three different postings each, we just saw incrementally things getting worse and worse in terms of bombings that could and should have been prevented, in terms of illegal phone taps and operations, and crucially in terms of two false flag terrorist attacks. The first of which was in London in 1994, when the Israeli embassy was car bombed in a very smart part of London. And this was blamed on two innocent Palestinians who were arrested, charged, and convicted of conspiracy to cause this attack. And they were both sentenced to 20 years each for this attack. And it turned out in the assessment of MI5, the senior officer in charge of the investigation, who'd seen all the evidence and all the intelligence, his assessment was that Mossad had bombed their own embassy in a controlled explosion. One, to gain increased security around Jewish interests in London, but primarily to shatter a Palestinian political network, which was growing very fast in London, and of which these two were members. So that was the first case, and that really made us sit up and think about what we got ourselves into. But the primary case was an assassination attempt against Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, and this happened in 1996. And in this case, it was an Islamic extremist terrorist group, which was paid by MI6, which is the external intelligence agency, sort of James Bond wing of British intelligence. And they paid money to this group to try and assassinate Gaddafi. And they'd done it illegally under UK law, because they hadn't gained the permission of their political masters. They can actually get the license to kill if they get prior written permission for illegal acts abroad. And the attack obviously went wrong. Gaddafi is still very much alive, but innocent people died. So this was the thing, this was the case that made David Shaler and I quit. We couldn't think of anything more heinous than the British state, the British intelligence agency, actually funding a group with Al-Qaeda connections to try and assassinate someone illegally and kill innocent people. So we decided to leave. We hadn't signed up to work for the British intelligence community in order to get involved in organizations that committed terrorism and killed innocent people. So we left. And in 1997, we ended up going public about our concerns about these crimes. And in fact, we ended up going to the newspapers, because under UK law, there's a piece of legislation called the Official Secrets Act, which makes it a crime to report a crime if you are an intelligence officer. So even though we were saying the spies have committed murder, we were the criminals by even saying that, and there was no investigation into MI6's murder attempt against Colonel Gaddafi. So we went to the press in order to, one, try and get enough attention to force an inquiry into this assassination attempt, but two, also for protection for ourselves. And we ended up blowing the whistle and having to go on the run around Europe.
And I know that's a long and harrowing story, too. But if we could nevertheless jump ahead a bit, You recall that I had the pleasure of meeting you and David in London in May of 05, and specifically, David and I sat across the aisle from each other on a bus trip to Manchester, and to say the least, David seemed to be an eminently sane and wonderful person, and yet, a lot of people here might not know, but more recently, David has been quoted, and I don't know what the facts are, as saying that he believes he's Jesus Christ, this kind of thing. Can you tell the true and inside story of what, how things came to be this way, and what really happened?
Well, it's a difficult story.
Well, prior to Annie Michon answering that question, you are listening to a conversation with Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon, former MI5 spy turned whistleblower. And this happened in May 09 at the University of Waterloo. So that's what you're listening to. Get back to it.
Sorry, I suppose. I mean, David was the primary whistleblower. And when you're a whistleblower in the UK, part of society sort of idolizes you because you've spoken out, and part of the society calls you a traitor. They say, how dare you speak out? So there's a sort of vilification and this idolization, which is quite a difficult mix, I think, for any human being to try and compute. And I think the pressure just got to him. I mean, over the years, he had gone to prison. He'd had to live in exile in France for 3 years as well. And he'd suffered a very unfair trial where he wasn't allowed to say why he'd done what he'd done. So I think all that pressure built up. There was also a sort of isolation as well from mainstream society and a constant struggle to survive financially. So there were all sorts of factors going on. We were quite isolated for quite a long time. And I suppose as well, he'd gone through all this trauma, and in 2006 he met a natural healer who suggested, well, you know, to help you through some of this trauma, there are these sort of Amazonian vine things, vine plants that can help you. Many people take this. It helps you go through your past life and deal with whatever's happened to you. And he had some treatment called ayahuasca, I think it's called, which is something that the tribes in the Amazon take. And that seemed to exacerbate all these different things that had hit him. It didn't help. It rather made it worse. In fact, this is the stuff that David Icke, I don't know how many of you are familiar with David Icke and his work, but he's another guy who's come out and talked about being the Messiah at one point and all the rest of it. He took this and also had the same Messiah moment. So in 2007, David decided to give some interviews to the media in the UK and say, you know, I'm the Messiah, I'm the reincarnation of the Christ consciousness and things. I have to say, looking back, though, I should have really spotted the signs a bit earlier. We separated as a couple in 2006, and I'm sure that probably didn't help his mindset either. But he was getting more and more intractable. I mean, he had got very involved with questioning the official account of 9/11 through 2005-2006. And because of his profile in the UK, had actually done a lot of good, building the movement, 9/11 movement, in the UK, and had got some media interviews. But then he started focusing on speculative fringe theories about what might have happened on 9/11 rather than focusing on the campaigning issue. And he was becoming more and more intractable and more and more difficult to work with and jeopardizing the work of many other people who are focusing on these sort of issues in the UK. So it just sort of spun out of control, really. And it's just very sad. I mean, many people say, well, did he do it deliberately to try and embarrass a political campaign or whatever? I think it's just a personal tragedy for a man who did something very brave 10 years ago by blowing the whistle and paid quite a heavy price for it, personally, and has lost his mind, I think. And he had a very fine mind.
It may be, it's quite a persuasive story. This is the first I've heard it, and it makes sense to me anyway. Mm. But I can't help but ask another question, because it would benefit those who were behind 9/11 and the establishment in general and so on, for David or yourself to be discredited in any way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And for a person to announce he's the Messiah, that's a pretty serious discreditation process. Is there any chance, and I'm really showing my high skepticism, if not paranoia here myself, is there any chance that this Amazonian healer was on the level, or would he himself have entrapped David somehow, led him down the worst garden path imaginable?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I know the guy as well. He's well known within the UK truth movement. I don't think so, but right. You can never rule these things out.
Yeah. Now, were you yourself charged with anything?
No, I was never charged. I was arrested and held on police bail for 6 months.
Yeah.
As was David's brother and his two best friends and a student activist and many journalists.
Right.
So this whole case just rippled out. You know, it wasn't just David who was implicated, but he was the one that went to prison twice. And, you know, it's a very frightening experience.
Yeah. The William Pepper, marvelous barrister and 9/11 truth activist, and otherwise an activist in connection with Martin Luther King's assassination and so on, has said, I've heard him say this three times in public speeches, that the 9/11 truth movement would be the number one target for agents of the state now, these days. And and I think you've partially covered that too. You've said, no doubt we have agents with us tonight. I can't imagine a 9/11 truth meeting that doesn't. But what would the ordinary 9/11 truth movement authentic person look for if they're trying to identify an inauthentic person, a person who is in fact planted to sow discord or simply do surveillance or whatever? What should we watch for?
I think you've just answered the question partially. One of the things, of course, is watch out for people who do try and stir up discord and dissent. One of the old cliches is that the state wants to divide and conquer any opposition, and that is just as true now as it was 2,000 years ago. So people who will deliberately try and argue and set people against each other and make accusations about, oh, so-and-so must be a shill, so-and-so's a government agent, and try and sow this discord and suspicion, some people can think like that and be slightly sort of wary and paranoid, but if other people take them aside and say, actually, you're causing more trouble, and they continue to do it, that, I would say, would be a bit of a giveaway. And actually, it would just be difficult to work with anyway, so why would you want to? But the other classic profile, and I feel uncomfortable saying this in a way, because I don't want people to suddenly start suspecting totally innocent people who are doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that MI5 used to do with political organizations was to insert an agent into a place where they had control of the information coming in. So they would be working on the administration side, they would be getting all the details of the activists, the personal details, particularly information that could lead to a proper identification of those activists for the purposes of investigation by the spies. So if anyone suddenly insists on volunteering and gathering up all the names and addresses and dates of birth and all the rest of it, which you don't need to run a 9/11 group, you can just do it using emails, I would say that would be quite suspicious too.
This reminds me that I remember reading some time ago that there was an executive secretary at the World Council of Churches based in Switzerland. He held the post for 25 years. The whole time, he was an agent for BOSS, the South African intelligence.
Yeah.
25 years, he was trusted by everybody. Turning to 9/11 now, for the couple of dozen of our friends in the audience here who believe that maybe incompetence explains the events of 9/11, or that they were allowed to happen on purpose, but no one went so far as to actually make them happen, what would, for instance, be three, in your opinion, three key pieces of evidence that do point toward a deliberate planned inside job from the White House level?
I wouldn't necessarily go as far as that myself even. I would say that there is a mountain of evidence from a wide variety of experts that contradicts the official account, and that's why we need a new and independent inquiry. Having said that, there are some key pieces. For example, the destruction of the three towers on the World Trade Center that day. It wasn't just the Twin Towers that we all remember coming down, but also WTC 7, World Trade Center 7, which fell at 5:20 that afternoon. Now, this was a massive skyscraper, 47 stories high, which is huge. It just looks small next to the Twin Towers. And that came down at freefall speed. It hadn't been hit by a plane. It hadn't been significantly damaged as far as anybody could see. and yet it fell down in a way that bore all the hallmarks of controlled demolition. Experts from that field have been shown that footage without knowing what it is, and have said that. And also, many scientists and physicists and architects and engineers are now questioning how that tower came down, why it came down. And in fact, the official report written by NIST, the National Institute for Science and Technology, yeah, which is, of course, a government department, investigating on behalf of the government, made up some new law of physics to explain the collapse of Building 7. It said, the steel sort of heated and had thermal expansion and got everything loose, and then it just fell down. That still wouldn't explain a massive building collapsing in on itself into its own footprint at free-fall speed. That couldn't physically happen. It would be a progressive collapse. And same with the Twin Towers. So those, I think, are key. And I would go with the experts, the hundreds of experts around the world, who are now questioning the official account because of the basic laws of physics. There's also, of course, many, many eyewitnesses in the towers who said that they heard massive explosions before the collapses and even before the first plane hit. People like William Rodriguez and Barry Jennings and various buildings, big explosions before any plane hit. So that would be key. As someone who's worked in intelligence, of course, the fact that many whistleblowers have come out of the FBI and said, well, we had some sort of intelligence saying there might be some sort of attack, and we were blocked from investigating by HQ. That is very suspicious to me. The fact there was no forensication of a crime scene at Ground Zero. That's against the law. Any crime scene needs to be blocked away and investigated properly, but it wasn't on Ground Zero, the biggest terrorist attack ever. And also, of course, the air defenses. Catastrophic failure across the country. The Pentagon is the most defended building in the world, and yet some cack-handed pilot who could barely fly a Cessna is supposed to have done this amazingly aerobatic turn, taking the huge airliner down 270 degrees, 7,000 feet in about 2 minutes, which is what many of the pilots in 9/11, who question 9/11 truth, say is physically impossible. And he's supposed to be able to do this. I mean, where do we stop? There's the put options, of course. Someone somewhere made a mint by betting on the stock market that the stock of American and United Airlines would plummet around that time. Now, the 9/11 Commission just dismissed this. They said, it doesn't lead to Al-Qaeda, therefore it's not important. Now, I'm sorry, if there's a major crime, you look at who benefits financially and you follow the money. That's usually a good indication of who might have had at least foreknowledge of it. But the 9/11 Commission didn't do its job. It was circumscribed by its executive director, Philip Delacour, an arch neocon. And even the chairs of the commission, Keenan Hamilton, have said publicly that it was set up to fail. So all these reasons to me say that we need a new inquiry, at the very least. And we need a new inquiry, not just for justice for the victims and for the first responders who were sick because they were lied to about the air quality at Ground Zero when they went to help their fellow human beings, but also justice for the people in the Middle East who have died as a result of 9/11 and the war on terror and the wars that then followed. I mean, millions of people have been killed and maimed and displaced. And we need answers, for all these people.
That's good, because you've also answered the next question that I had about why we need a new investigation.
Oh, hi, friends. This is Raymond from Unbought and Unbossed. Just letting you know that you are listening to an interview or discussion between Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon, discussing 9/11 right now. So there you go. I hope you're enjoying this. This was from Waterloo earlier this year, May. So there it is, Barry Zwicker and Annie Michon in conversation.
For centuries, rulers have employed spies to infiltrate and undermine and take control of movements. Now, there is something, therefore, which some people call, and I call, the invisible government. These are, shall we say, the powers that be, sometimes called the global elite, the global supra society, the permanent committee, and have been for a long time secret societies, the Freemasons, we have the Skull and Bones Club at Yale, Council of Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers. Probably a lot of people are familiar with a lot of these interlaced, very secretive, always very secretive groups that possess an undue power compared to, shall we say, the rest of us. Now, how do you If you were to characterize the powers that be yourself as to where would you say are the most the strongest centers of power and control and influence and wealth and privilege, where what's the heart of the invisible government, shall we say? Mm.
I think many of the groups you just mentioned, actually. Certainly from a national perspective in the UK, of course, we're renowned in Britain for having this amazingly rigid class system, which is still in place. And the ruling class has always been sort of labelled the establishment. And they tend to be interlinked in business, intelligence, politics, the media. People who tended to go to the right schools and the right universities. And they quite often, you know, will work within a number of these fields. So they're interchangeable, they all know each other, and they work in their interests, not in the national interest. Although they tend to justify to themselves that it is the national interest, it's their class interest. And I think on an international scale, it's the same sort of principle. So we have these think tanks like Chatham House in the UK, the Trilateral Commission, the Council for Foreign Relations. Of course, President Obama is a member of the latter two, I think, as well as the Bilderberger Group, where we have these international groupings of the same sort of people. So, you know, top politicians, the heads of multinational businesses, top spies, top military personnel, top media owners, who come together for these informal discussions and can decide, you know, where the next trends are going to come from, what areas they need to focus on, what to do about various wars being waged, that sort of thing. And they might say, well, it's just us comparing notes and having a chat, and it's very helpful to us all. But of course, they are taking decisions behind closed doors, which are never then ratified or discussed openly within our national democracy. These are working above our national governments, so there is no democratic involvement for us, and there's no oversight. And that is the issue, I think, here. We're not talking about some evil cabal necessarily. We are talking about a lack of oversight and transparency and accountability, and that is a problem for us all. And it's interesting as well with the Bilderberger Group particularly. I mean, you go back 10 years and people would say, oh, that's just a mad conspiracy theory on the internet. Now, of course, it's out in the open. Everyone knows the Bilderberg exists. In fact, they just had their most recent meeting in Greece. So the perception of it has shifted massively in a decade. And I think that is true of a number of these issues. You know, it's very easy for the mainstream media to dismiss people discussing issues like 9/11 as conspiracy theory. But when you look at the evidence, the information out there, it is rock solid. There is so much evidence from so many reputable people, you know, politicians, military whistleblowers, governments, scientists, architects, engineers, intelligence officers, a whole range of credible people, as well as millions of concerned citizens. And it's just insulting, frankly, to just be dismissed.
The question of 9/11 can be characterized different ways. Personally, my view is that if you think of these powers that be, that you've just discussed, as a chain, and you want to break the chain or weaken it, that you should go for the weakest link if you want to break a chain. And so I wonder to what extent you might agree or not with the thought that 9/11, that is to reveal the truth about 9/11, which I take to be, the word truth is big, but which I take to be, I might go beyond where you would, that the evidence not only raises questions about who did it, shows us who benefits, but there are also lines that lead directly to the White House, specifically to say to Dick Cheney. Mm-hmm. We have actual evidence that he was in command on that day of planes flying and so forth. But anyway, to what extent would you agree or not that this is the greatest Achilles heel that an oligarchy has ever had? In other words, 9/11 was the largest false flag operation in history, I would submit, and therefore to reveal that it was a dirty trick, an inside job, where thousands of people were killed deliberately by their government for these aims of world domination and resource theft. Would you agree that this is the most important issue, therefore, where we can apply our pressure on that weakest link? Or do you have a different view of it?
I think there are so many weak links
That's why we need so many different professional groups mm-hmm. to attack on all these different fronts.
Good point.
And all we need to do, of course, as you say, is just get one to go. Well, we have got these weak links that have been broken on many fronts already. The trouble is the mainstream media is not picking up on this and reporting on it. Yeah. So most people are not aware of it. And this is something, I mean, how do we get around this? Well, you know, we do have the internet, thank God. That does help to spread things, but it also makes it easier to dismiss some of these issues, because then the mainstream media and opinion formers can say, oh, it's just, you know, kooks on the internet. It's not. It's a lot of credible people. We've had, for example, the leader of the Japanese Senate, the opposition in the Japanese Senate, Yukihisa Fujita. He's a Japanese MP, very senior, very well respected, asking questions about 9/11 in the Japanese parliament, putting basic evidence in front of the Japanese parliament. He's now leading a group called Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth, with politicians all around the planet questioning this. And yet this is not being reported in the mainstream media. We've had whistleblowers coming out. We have the scientists talking about all these issues. And it's, where do we go? And I think we need to be careful as a campaign, as a movement, not to speculate too much about what might have happened, because then we do see more and more people speculating more and more wildly onto more of the fringe theories, which then do lead to discreditation of the entire movement in the way that, you know, association with David Shaler has caused, which makes me very cautious about speculating about actually what did happen on the day. And we just need to be very disciplined in saying, well, look, we have these questions. We have evidence that directly contradicts the official account. We need a new inquiry. And try and gain some sort of leverage at a sort of political level, mainstream level, with that credibility. But also, crucially, we do need people to go out and do the research and potentially find the smoking gun. But as well as, I feel very passionately about this, so many people around the planet feel dispossessed from the whole political process. They're turned off from mainstream politics. It's unrepresentative. And I think the whole war in Iraq as well was an issue that took away hope from people, because millions of us marched against the war and it didn't make a blind bit of difference. So it sort of turns people off from activism. What we can do with 9/11 is use it as a key. Whichever area fascinates us most, whichever area we have expertise on, pursue it. And use it as this key to unlock the issue. You know, it is a sort of keystone, I suppose, that can bring the whole building tumbling down. And it can rejuvenate people's interest in politics. It can lead to all sorts of areas of interesting research that open people's eyes to a wide variety of different issues that are interlinked as well. And it can re-empower people. And I think, yes, let's go for a new inquiry. Let's run a credible campaign. Let's try and gain leverage in the media and, you know, the chattering classes. But also, crucially, get people focusing on what they can do as concerned citizens with a responsibility for their country, their government, and what is done in their name. And that's why I think 9/11 is quite an amazing movement. You know, I haven't seen a political movement like this before. So really, it's sort of a case of get out there and get active while we still can.
Thank you very much for that. You mentioned the media several times, and it happens that I've been in the media all my life, and then I became a media critic in 1970, and even earned my living to a great extent from analyzing media. And I underwent a long learning process in that connection, because I saw from the inside that, in fact, there are such things as sloth, and there's careerism, and there are some stultifying journalism traditions, such as he said, she said journalism. You don't try to find the truth. Just get one person to express this, another person to express that. You've done your story. Go home. And much else, of course, that is not helpful regarding media production. I would say at the same time, there's a lot of very good work done in various newspapers, but not nearly enough, especially on these overarching subjects. Now, specifically, 9/11, to me, is the supreme litmus test, actually, for every person, every organization, every craft and discipline. And the newspapers, the media in general, the mainstream media especially, but also most of the so-called alternative media, have abjectly failed. They have exerted de facto censorship now for 8 years. So I've been asked about that a lot, and you can trot out these various reasons because of the ownership, primarily the corporate ownership, the owners, choose the top executives, mm-hmm. who choose the lower executives, all the way down, the whole organization becomes suffused with the value system of the owners. And the owners are part of this establishment you mentioned.
Yeah.
And one way or another, they will find ways to stifle the stuff that's really embarrassing, and one of the most embarrassing things are false flag ops. However, I've come to the conclusion that a huge reason for this de facto censorship is that the, and I'm speculating here, mm-hmm. for sure, but I'm asking your reaction to my speculation. I'm thinking that one of the most powerful reasons for this de facto censorship going on day after day all around the world in all the media is because of the huge number of moles that are planted in the media at choke points, who are recruited into the media by MI5, by CSIS, by the CIA, all the intelligence networks. And then they work their way up where they become producers, line producers, executive editors, and so forth. And they, I actually have some proof that this happens, but I don't have enough proof to support my big generalization that a large part of the reason for this de facto censorship is a legion of moles. And this doesn't contradict the fact that the owners want this. I mean, they allow them to be hired and so forth. However, do you think I'm being extreme? And whether you do, how extensive would you say is the existence of moles in the media as an explanation for this blanket censorship?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a very human response going on with many journalists anyway, which is they are scared of the issue of 9/11 because they worry about their credibility. That's just a human issue. But I do agree with you. I wouldn't use the term mole, perhaps. I'd use the term agent of influence, which is what goes on in the UK, where the journalists on national newspapers are sort of seduced into this charmed circle, be it of spies or parliamentary briefings or government briefings or whatever. And they become reliant on the stories and briefings that are fed to them by the intelligence agencies and government systems. And they are known as agents of influence in the UK media. So it's the same principle, absolutely, and many of them will continue working in the media and go up to higher levels. So they are choke points, you're right. And in fact, there's one very famous man in the UK who went public about this. He admitted to it. A guy called David Rose, in an interview he did last year, saying that, yes, he got seduced into this lifestyle. And it's very easy. They can be quite lazy because they're given the stories. They don't have to check them. If they do try and contradict them, the stories dry up anyway, so they lose their job. So they go along with it. It's very seductive. That's a form of control. There's also, there are departments within the spy agencies which are specifically there to plant stories in the media and to spin stories in the media. MI6 has a section called Information Operations, which is contracted down to IOPS. So that's a formal way of control, but I think it's very much the sort of agent of influence mole aspect is not far off the mark at all. I think it's very real, as well as this sort of proprietorial tone which is set, as well as the editorial tone which is set, as well as the self-censorship the media goes through as well in the UK, certainly. It's a very subtle form of control. There's a very good book which came out by a man called Nick Davies. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a very famous UK journalist, investigative journalist. And it was published last year. It's called Flat Earth News. And he had some university research done. And it turned out that all these aspects influence the media, of course. He was looking at why the media is being dumbed down. All these aspects influence. But also, fewer journalists have fewer hours to churn out. He calls it churnalism now. Mm-hmm. Churn out double the amount of copy they would have had to do 20 years ago. So they're on this constant hamster wheel of trying to fill the space as well. So that sort of lowers their time to investigate stuff. So there's all these different influences, but yes, moles do exist. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that the internet journalism is an interesting development because, you know, the younger media types are working more on the internet, and that's more collaborative. People share information. The readers rate up and down what's a good story. And I think that sort of mentality of working on the internet is going to shift control away from the proprietors, from this sort of state apparatus, and will democratize our media again when more and more people just read the internet.
That's
media.
Already happened.
It's already happened.
And
yeah.
We have that slogan, be the media,
yeah.
Just to a great extent happening. And one of the most important contributions of good journalism is investigative journalism.
Yeah.
And it's more important than any other kind. And but it's expensive, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as the mainstream media do less investigative journalism, I would say, submit, that the 9/11 Truth Movement has become the largest investigative journalism project on the planet. It's multidisciplinary. Yeah. You mentioned all the engineers and physicists and so on. It's global, and it uses the latest technology to disseminate. So we are being the media in a very big way.
Yeah.
We also have to be our own PR agents. We have to be our own everything. Okay, here's just a simple question that you can answer in 3 minutes, which is what we have left. How do you see the next 10 years unfolding in respect of the global political, geopolitical, and economic and environmental situations concerned?
That's an easy question. You have three minutes. I think we're in a race, actually, between the powers that be, the transnational powers and our government power, governments, trying to clamp down on our freedoms, to stifle our dissent, where they are turning, certainly the UK is already there, our country is into a police state, where we don't have any rights. We've had our constitution shredded. And the spies and police have wide-sweeping, wide-ranging powers to investigate us, and they do. So there's that race. They're trying to clamp down on us. And on the other side, many of us are really waking up to the reality of what's going on and trying to spread the word as fast as possible and getting people as active as fast as possible to take back their democratic power. So I see it as a bit of a race, not just on the front of 9/11, not just on the front of the wars and the issues of torture and extraordinary rendition and the shredding of our rights in our countries, but also in terms, of course, of the environment, as you say, because that comes down to all these interlinkages between government and big business as well. You know, we need the governments to rein in big business, to stop all this pollution, to slow down the environmental problems we're having. And yet they're not doing it because of this interlinkage. The establishment is protecting its own interests, not our interests, not the planet's interests, and certainly not our children's interests.
Your countryman, H.G. Wells, said history is a race between education and catastrophe. Use the term race. Thanks very much, Annie.
Thank you very much.
We just finished on time.
Perfect.